You're listening to Truth To You with Jono, and you can download these programs freely from the website at truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. And g'day to Paul, Darren, Gracie, and Catherine, and everybody listening wherever you may be around the world. And thank you for your company. This is part two of the discussion on Shabbat as we learn from the Levite in the land. Welcome back to the program, Yoel Ben Shlomo.
Yep, back again for another brainstorming session about Shabbat.
About Shabbat. And of course, Paul, Darren, Gracie, and Catherine left some comments. We're going to be discussing some of those in just a moment. Before we kick off with that, let me just read the commandment. This, of course, is the fourth commandment we're talking about. Exodus 20, verse 8 to 11, which says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your strangers who are within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." There it is. That's the that's the fourth commandment, and out of all 10 commandments, that one, I think it's fair to say, has the most detail, has the most words dedicated to that particular commandment.
Yeah, there are a lot of details here in this one, it's true. Actually, just before we go on the show, I actually listened to the 10 commandments with the Aramaic translation. It's very interesting. I noticed there was that I was listening to it because I was doing something else, but I was looking at the translation, and it says there's a very interesting game there with the meaning of to remember. So in the Hebrew it says "Zachor et Yom HaShabbat leKadesho." So the direct translation that would be what you translate is "Remember the day of the Sabbath." But in the Aramaic, they did something completely different, which expresses a sort of mindset about Shabbat, which is, it says "haveh dachir," or "haveh dachir," depends which accent you want to use. Mm-hmm. And "haveh" is the Aramaic counterpart of the verb "haya." And here it's using a present tense for the verb "haya," which is extremely rare, at least in Hebrew. But what it's actually saying here is not remember, but be in remembering. So it's slightly different than just saying the same "remember," and what it says is like as if being remembering, basically just live it. And in the Jewish world, there's this practice, and I don't think it's a correct translation. I think it's expressing an idea. Uh-huh. And in the Jewish world, when we always prepare towards Shabbat, we always have a joke in places where everyone has physical work. It's physical labor. It's very difficult. We always say we live from Shabbat to Shabbat. We kind of strive, our entire week just strives to reach that. Friday afternoon, we just forget of everything. So it used to be a very old practice in the Jewish world that everything you do, you're preparing towards Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about that more when we reach the issue about practices in Judaism about towards Shabbat. But there's always the stories about someone, you go out to the market, the Talmud says, Tractate of Shabbat says, you go out to the market and you find something which you think will be worthwhile for Shabbat, you buy it for Shabbat, even if it's a Wednesday.
Nice. Well, this is the thing. I mean, whenever you start talking about Shabbat, inevitably you're going to get questions where people tend to enter into what is commonly defined as the gray areas. And what do I do in case this happens, and what do I do in case that happens? And they're all very valid questions, of course. And the first comment that we got was from Paul, and I know you had a look at this. And what Paul says is, he said, "I really appreciate your mission. I like the insights that your different guests are bringing up." He says, "I have a few questions. What about fire for heat? I can understand fire for food, but what about heat?" Second question that he had was, "We have a commercial goat dairy." Now, this is an interesting thing and something I can relate to. Well, we have goats. We don't have a commercial goat dairy, but we have goats for our own personal milk. He says, "We milk twice a day, 7 days a week. We make goat cheese," which I love goat cheese, "and we have to pasteurize them every other day, and sometimes it becomes necessary to pasteurize on the Sabbath, and we need some advice." Now, I sort of answered in a roundabout way in the comments section, but I kind of missed the point that Paul was making, and that was that he is pasteurizing the milk every other day. So obviously he has a cycle by which You know, you milk in the morning, you milk in the evening, you collect the milk, and then when there's a certain amount of milk, I assume, they pasteurize it. And every now and then, the need to pasteurize falls on a Shabbat. This is the question that he has as far as I can understand it. I don't know that much about the process of pasteurization. We just have raw goat's milk here. But how would you answer that? First of all, shall we kick off with the heat? Because we talked about using fire for food, cooking, and so on and so forth. What about heating? Because there's a lot of people that live in a lot of cold places around the globe.
Okay, so I've been asked this question about heating many times. So first of all, my first answer is always, if you were living in Israel, it wouldn't be that cold.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's not a practical answer. Mm. Okay, so we're flipping back to the issue of fire, because heating in the past used to be with fire.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I would say we have to answer several questions before we can actually say 100% how to treat this issue. I want to clarify something. I'm not a rabbi. I can't give you a definite answer. I can give you an idea, a direction,
mm-hmm.
But you really, really have to think it out for yourself. Don't take my word on everything, because there's always like little details, little tits and tittles that I don't know of unless I see them. I have a lot of experience in Jewish halakha, because this is the world I grew up in. Mm. So you know, you don't have to be a rabbi to answer every question.
Mm.
Okay. I have my own rabbi. If I have questions I don't know, I go to my rabbi. There's nothing I can do about it. And questions have been forwarded to me. And someone wanted either the Karaite opinion or the rabbinical opinion. If it was a Karaite opinion, then there's Karaite wise men or Karaite elders I can ask, mm-hmm. people I know, what is the practice in the Karaite world? And if someone wants to know the rabbinical one, I just go to my rabbi or any other rabbi I know. I just go to my rabbi because he understands the complexity of some of these questions mm. better than other people. So I ask him if I don't know the answer. So I'm going to give a general observation here. Each person has to make his own decision. Mm. But when it comes to the issue of heating, so first of all, heating doesn't necessarily have to come from fire. Now, a person who has central heating, there's a pilot. There's a system there with a pilot.
True.
And if you switch that thing on and off all the time, it's sometimes very tricky to switch it back on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here in Israel, for example, we don't work that way. We don't use gas, because natural gas here is pretty problematic.
Mm-hmm.
The price of electricity, for example, is going up all the time, because the gas line from Egypt to Israel is always being blown up.
Yes.
So there's always a shortage of gas. We don't use it that way. We use electricity. So when you have electricity, you raise a question, can you use electricity during Shabbat? So the practice in Israel is that most people will use electricity, because electricity is not produced specifically for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's been produced also for hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of like riding on the back of that. We're just saying, okay, the electricity is being produced for the hospitals because it's for life-sustaining and it's for the military and everything. So we're riding on top of that. But we try to minimize the amount of electricity running in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have electricity going for the major things. We don't disconnect our fridge. Karaites, for example, some of the older Karaites, which refused to use electricity, used to disconnect their fridge. There used to be a time where they used to sell in the streets. I mean, even in the 1980s, you still had this in Israel. They used to sell blocks of ice. You just put your block of ice in the fridge, in the freezer, and you can just keep everything still cold.
Uh-huh.
It's a slightly a mess afterwards of cleaning it up, unless you put it in some kind of bucket or something.
Sure.
And put it in there.
Yeah.
But I never grew up with that, by the way. When I was a child, my parents came from England, so they already knew that you don't have an ice box anymore, you use an actual fridge.
Mm.
But here in Israel, a lot of people still use ice boxes, and they were still selling. I remember as a child, it was very rare, but they used to sell these big blocks of ice.
Mm.
It became very rare by, I think, 1988. It was gone. You wouldn't see, they were just selling regular refrigeration. That was it. But anyhow, so first of all, electricity. So electricity itself, as I mentioned in the first part of this conversation, electricity in Israel is produced through the burning of gas and fossil oils and things like that, and coal and things like that. So there's actual fire. So there are people in the ultra-Orthodox world who would not use electricity. They have their own generator. It's not because they say you can't have the fire. It's because the people working in the factory to produce the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so they eliminate that that labor by using their own generator.
Exactly, and they're not really working. They're not doing anything to get the thing running. you jumpstart it on Friday and it works.
Sure.
And it's passive. It's completely passive. Sure. Okay. So there's no, in the rabbinical mindset, there's no problem with that. Mm-hmm. In the Karaite mindset, it's a bit more complex because the Karaites were influenced by a certain idea that if you start something even several days before Shabbat and it goes on during Shabbat, you're in a problem. Now, the rabbinical mindset doesn't hold by that opinion. You actually have to do an action to make it forbidden. Okay. And this is a very complex discussion. I actually started off this discussion again with Nehemiah Golden. We spoke about this yesterday. We had a meeting, so we just sat down and spoke about that. And we're still trying to define many things when it comes to fire, because really the spectrum about fire is extremely wide. I mean, there's so many ideas you can present about the issue of fire. I mean, what I presented last week was my personal opinion, but the spectrum is extremely wide. I mean, there's even an opinion that says if fire is not for work, you can start it. Like you said on the and your response there on the comments. So you know it's a very complex.
That, it should be noted though, and I think I did mention as well that particular opinion is not the opinion of the majority. Not that we necessarily go by the majority, but it should be noted that my opinion and the way that I understand Exodus 35 verse 3 is certainly by far not the opinion of the majority in Israel and not practiced by Orthodox Jews. It's really, it comes down
to... All Karaites.
So it comes down to basically the two main opinions are you may be comfortable with starting a fire the night before and leaving it burning the following day, and that's one way to interpret it, or you just don't have a fire burning on a cold winter's Sabbath. That's the other interpretation. But yeah, I do interpret it saying that it is within the context of work. I base that on the previous two verses. But it's the kind of thing that people have to come to their own conclusion on with much study and prayer. So there's really not a fourth option as far as I'm aware.
I would say that there actually are... So actually, there are actually four options, I would say. The other two I would add would be that you're allowed to produce fire if it's not for work. That's the third option.
That's the third, yeah.
The fourth option involves the labor in producing fire. It's not that the fire by itself, by essence, is what's forbidden. It's the issue of the labor around
producing fire that is not labor-intensive, as is the majority of fires these days that we produce, then that too is okay. But I suppose that is a valid opinion. But
that's a break off from the discussion about the man who was collecting wood.
Aha, we're going to be getting there fairly soon.
So. We're going to be getting there, but let me answer the question. What I would say very simply, first of all, is that if there's a way of, depending on the opinion, let's take the more strict opinion, that you can't have a fire burning. Mm-hmm. If you take the opinion that says, oh, if you don't start the fire, okay, so just leave that pilot on, and if it heats up the house, it heats up the house, you don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're not doing anything active, you're fine. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. Sure. Part of the rabbinical opinion says, if you're not active, don't think about it. Just don't, if something goes wrong, unless it's dangerous, don't touch it. If it stops working, don't touch it. Mm-hmm. But if it's on and it's heating up the house, you don't have to think about it. So that's an easier opinion. And I usually tell people in areas where they have small children or it's a very cold area, I just tell them, do that. Mm-hmm. Just leave the heat on, leave the pilot on, set it before Shabbat, and don't touch it afterwards if you want to take a more strict opinion. Mm. It is a very good question because, for example, if you're living in the mountains of Judea, if you're living in the mountains of Samaria, where it's actually cold, I mean, we get snow in these areas. Mm. What did people do in the past? And that brings us to the discussion regarding why is the fire there? Mm-hmm. And it does not make sense that people during the winter when it's freezing cold will be sitting there just covered, huddled up and covered. It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. And that in itself is a very valid argument because we know that he's a rational God. He's given us common sense. He expects us to use it. He's the God that says to us, come, let us reason together. So he expects us to be reasonable and to exercise common sense. And we have to weigh that which is part of his character, we have to weigh that up as well and say, what would he have us do on a freezing cold, snowy Shabbat?
I do agree that you have to use common sense, and you look at the flaw here in the sense of like, oh, we don't have to fire at all. So it has to be one of two. Either you're allowed to have a fire burning before Shabbat, or that you're allowed to start the fire during Shabbat if it's not laborers, because to keep the house warm. You're not producing the fire to cook. You're not producing the fire to melt down metals. You're not producing the fire for war, whatever it would be. Mm. You're producing the fire to keep yourself warm so you don't freeze to death.
Sure. Just to elaborate on what I just said, I'm talking about Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18, that says, "Come now," Yehovah says to us, "Come now, let us reason together." And what I suppose I mean, if I can elaborate on that, is that he expects us to be able to reason with him. Perhaps you can elaborate on the Hebrew words that are used there and what the connotation is. What is the Hebrew word in 18 where it says, "Come now," and I know we're sort of jumping off the topic a little bit, but in verse 18 where it says, "Come now and let us reason together." Reason together, reason. What is the word used
for
reason?
The word here is levachecha. Levachecha. It can be translated in different ways. It can be levachach in something is to be aware of something and suddenly realize something. So levachecha can also be argue from the word vikuach. There are several options here of how to translate the word. I mean, let me pull out one of the commentators I have here on Isaiah.
Because I'm wondering, is it possible even for it to have a legal connotation to it?
It might. Again, when you're shown facts and you have to make a decision or you realize something, it can have a legal connotation.
Sure.
But so that this can is, do with a lot of words.
So this is my point, and I guess what I'm saying is he expects us to be able to weigh these things up with him, to be reasonable about these things. He's given us the ability. He himself is reasonable. He's given us the ability to reason. And this is what it comes down to when we're...
No, it's of course what differs a human being from an animal is the ability to think and understand and conclude things. Animals usually work on instinct. Animals conclude things, but it's mostly instinct. On the other hand, human beings, what differs us, besides the ability to communicate in actual structured speech, you know, whales, for example, which have some of the whales and dolphins have some most complex ways of communication between animals, still do not have a complex language like human beings developed. And we not only that we have complex language, we also have complex languages. We have the ability to develop all languages as just one.
Mm.
So I would say that obviously God gave us the ability to think. I mean, if it wasn't that way, the Torah just would be put into our hard drives and just carried on and just carry on with it. Absolutely. And we don't even think about it, or we just do it and that's it.
But we do, but and then as you say, difference. That's what makes us different from the animals is our ability to complexly work out and reason together and come to a conclusion in a complex way. He expects us to do that. He's given us the ability to do that. And in any case, here we are doing exactly that with the topic of Shabbat.
So the issue here is very, very simple. If you have a way of heating up your house without the fire, try to find that solution. Mm-hmm. If you get some electrical device or something to keep the house heated, I know if you're in the U.S., it's not cheaper because the gas system is cheaper, but that can be a solution.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it really depends how strict you want to be when it comes to practices like this. Okay, it just depends how you read this and everything. And again, when there's something very, very important I have to explain here. One day we'll know the exact answers. One day when everything's reestablished and we have a better understanding of the Torah, we'll be able to answer these questions in a definite way. Mm. At the moment, because in the reality we're in, it really depends on each individual what they decide. Mm. But every time you want to make a decision, you have to take many things, sometimes many things into your calculation and then decide it. This is why for me, for example, in this one, because it's Shabbat, and Shabbat is a very heavy thing, and Shabbat is a covenant between us and God to an extent where it says if anyone does any work on Shabbat, they'll be cut off, I'm a lot more careful. This is why I'm more careful. I mean, I really, truthfully, have no problem with the opinion. Okay, though I'm Orthodox, I'm just saying in general, I have no problem with the opinion that says that it only has to do if you're going to produce the fire for work. Mm-hmm. It's logical. The problem is I'm worried of doing something I'm not supposed to do.
Sure. So that's
not the general approach in Judaism. Yeah.
So it's not what you do, but you acknowledge that's a valid interpretation. And so that should be noted. But when it comes to heating and cooking and things like that, we're talking about needs, and there is obviously a difference between needs and wants. And the second question that he had, he said, we have a commercial.
Actually, you have to be very careful with the need and want.
Mm.
Remember, always remember, in every decision you make in life, including these ones, you always have to take the account of the problem of the need and the want that a human being has.
Mm.
Some of us make decisions based on the want and not on the need.
Mm.
Okay?
That's
many
right.
of us do that, and it causes a lot of trouble. I've seen people do things which are completely forbidden on Shabbat because they understand it's a necessity, it's a need.
Mm.
Okay? And it's not a need and not a necessity. It's completely prohibited, and you can survive without this.
Mm.
You know, for example, someone had a discussion with me about having a hot shower during Shabbat. And the problem with a hot shower is you're heating up the water. Over 1,000 years ago, they understood this as well. And this is why in Jewish law, heating up water in any temperature is forbidden. So, and this, by the way, has to do with all things. If you say you're not allowed to, people are going to say this does not work. If we say you're not allowed to cook during Shabbat, based on the verses we spoke last time, then you have a problem.
Okay, so what you're saying is that
if
you come to that conclusion based on Exodus 35 verse 3, then you have to take into consideration things like a hot shower. Exactly. So what you're saying is you're saying to be consistent with your conclusion, right?
Exactly. Make sure you're always consistent with your conclusion. Don't say, oh, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. You have to be very consistent. This is something you really have to pay attention
sure.
to.
I would agree with
that. If you make a decision, it has an effect on everything else.
Okay.
By the way, you mentioned something about, you know, questions and everything. You should know something very, very simple. And I mentioned this last time as well.
Mm.
The number of books written about Shabbat is huge.
Mm.
You can fill up libraries with it. There's so many books. I mean, you walk into a Jewish bookstore and it's just, you can have entire shelves just on one subject.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's over-complexing Judaism. I agree. I don't like it. And I don't follow everything that have been written in these books because some of the things is complete nonsense,
mm.
and I have proof that it's complete nonsense.
Mm.
But this is why I use the older basic books that, you know, deal with things a bit more logically. But today, you know, you open up a rabbinical book about electricity. There's this man I know. He wrote a 5-volume book. I think it was either 3 or 5 volumes just about electricity.
Thanks. Three, four, five volumes on electricity.
And each book is like 3 pages long. It's like electricity for Shabbat encyclopedia.
Oh, dude, that's okay. All right. It must be a riveting read. I think I
got so mad with some of these people. Like, how does he do that? I mean, I remember
because I don't think that God is a pedantic, obsessive, compulsive God. Would you agree?
Listen, these are not questions. These are not types of questions we have to ask ourselves. Questions we have to ask ourselves is, what has he given us in the Torah? What are the words of the Torah saying?
Yes.
And the moment we know what the Torah is saying, we can sometimes like ignore hundreds of years of discussions.
Sure.
Because the premise of the discussion is completely wrong.
Sure.
And I've seen it. I've seen entire pages written under a certain premise which was completely wrong. You know, anyone who's been in the academy, or anyone who does it in mathematics, you can write a very, very long equation or a very, very long essay, and there's one very simple flaw in the understanding in the beginning, and then everything you wrote is complete nonsense.
There's the disclaimer, but we got to move on to the next part, and that was the goat dairy, which really I'm excited about. I should mention, by the way, Paul's website, which I just thought was wonderful, which is www.humbleheartfarms.com. Really great website if you're excited about goats, which I am.
Actually, I saw that website. It's actually very nice. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but it was a well done, very nice. And goat
nice,
milk,
goat cheese recipes there, and if you're in the vicinity, it's probably worth visiting. But the goat dairy. Now, I mean, when you take the kids off the goats, you've got to milk them. You can't not milk them for a day. This is one thing.
If you stop milking, they'll just stop producing milk.
Well, not just that, but it can be very uncomfortable for the.
It accumulates and creates infections.
It accumulates and mastitis can develop and things like that. So they have to be milked. Pasteurization. I don't know that much about the process, and I would be inclined to say that if it can be avoided,
you never learn about Louis Pasteur and the process.
Oh no, I know what pasteurization is, but I don't know why every other day and how much milk you're accumulating before you pasteurize, all that sort of stuff.
That probably is a technical issue that they have there. But basically, for people who don't know what the pasteurization system is, in the 1800s, a man called Louis Pasteur discovered they can kill a lot of bacteria, a lot of dangerous bacteria, by heating up the milk. Now, each thing has its different temperature. I think milk is like 86 degrees Celsius. I don't know what Fahrenheit is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really cooking the milk. So that's actually a problem, because you are changing the milk. You're not only killing bacteria. Really, to tell you the truth, pasteurized milk is not really good because it's lacking a lot of other things. So there's a different system of still keeping it raw milk, but keeping off any dangerous bacteria. There is a way.
But if you've got a commercial dairy and you're selling it to the public, there are certain laws by which you have to abide by, and pasteurization may be one of those. But what you've just said is very interesting, because even if you interpret Exodus 35 verse 3 as I do, and I say, you know, that it pertains to work-related fire and therefore work-related cooking, then you have a problem. You still have a problem because you're pasteurizing the milk. That is a commercial goat dairy. Therefore, I can't really see a way out around that. And I would be inclined to say, try and do it on the Friday, or try and do it on the Sunday morning. Or
can you do it immediately after Shabbat?
Yeah, do it immediately after.
So when it comes to the milking of the animal, that, like I wrote in the comment, when it comes to milking the animal, goats, for example, can't last that long. So what they do here in Israel, a person who has a small farm of his own, they milk them, but they're not milking them to make the money. They milk them and then they pour the milk. They get rid of it. They don't use it. Large places, usually they have a non-Jews working there. And this is a complete other discussion regarding Shabbat and people which are not Jewish and people who decide they're not in the covenant, stuff like that. That's another very very annoying discussion, which I do not like having with people. But the practice is that they have Filipino or Thai workers, Chinese workers, whatever it would be, they come, they operate the machinery during Shabbat to milk the cows and milk the goats.
The Sabbath goy.
What's called the Sabbath goy, which is a... I don't like. I really don't like that. I can show you proof in the text that you can have such a thing, but because what it says there is slave and not worker. It doesn't say schilcha.
Yeah.
It says iman yanoch avdecha v'amatecha, people who you own or things that you own. Okay, but not someone who works for you. So this person, but you're paying them.
I mean,
so it's very iffy. I mean, I thank God have never had to use a non-Jewish person for Shabbat. But the general practice is that you do milk the animal because it's unhealthy for the animal. It's unhealthy for your business. But what you do, they just discard the milk, just get rid of it.
Okay, so I use the example of the chicken laying an egg. I mean, you can collect the eggs on the first day, the day after Shabbat, and you can you incorporate those eggs into if you're selling eggs, can you sell those eggs?
Well, you haven't done anything active.
Sure, it was the chicken that laid the egg.
Let me ask a very simple question. I don't remember exactly how the process of milk being produced in an animal works, but anything in reality, things are always being active. The question is, are you the one participating in the action itself? That's the question.
That's the question.
The trees are growing. The apple is being produced. The chicken is producing eggs in its system all the time. If you open up a chicken and an egg layer, they have rolls of eggs in different stages inside the stomach.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. So it could be said that the goat is producing the milk. The milk is produced. You're just extracting it, but it's part of your labor. It's part of your duties as your commercial.
Extraction is the labor. The production has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Because
you can say
the milk was produced in the animal during Shabbat. So the milk, if it takes 24 hours to be produced, though it doesn't. But say you milk the cow at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. It takes 8 hours to fill up. and at 8 o'clock in the evening, it's ready after sunset. Don't use that milk because it was produced by the cow during Shabbat. You know, that's kind of like stretching it. Yeah. I won't be surprised if someone who claimed that, but, you know.
No, that's interesting. But if you extract the milk, if you milk the cow or you milk the goat on Shabbat because you have to, so the question becomes, what do you do with that milk? And what you're saying is there are some Orthodox farmers that will just pour it out, that will just let it go.
Not some, all Orthodox.
So it is okay.
And anyone who has a kosher certificate is told to pour that milk down the drain.
That's the common practice. Okay.
Farmers don't keep Shabbat and don't keep kosher would either manufacture this milk as without a kosher stamp on it, or they sell it. They sell it to Europe or something, and it goes there.
Okay. So I will admit that when we've had a goat and she hasn't had the kids for whatever reason, and we've had to milk her on Shabbat, we've kept the milk because it just seems like an unnecessary waste to let it go. But at the same time, I don't suppose we're not a commercial dairy, but I find that difficult. But that's the common practice is what you're saying in Israel.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm looking at Darren. Darren's got a comment. Looking forward to parts 2, 3, and 4. This is the second one.
This might be 103, 109 million. Yeah.
Or whatever it takes to grasp a better understanding of Shabbat from Yod's translation of Hebrew. Now, let me see. What does he say? My wife and I always debate about driving our family on Shabbat, and I never felt quite right when we did. And now the answer is no to driving. So he's taken that conclusion. He's not going to be driving anymore. And thanks to Yod for...
If you conclude that, you have to be consistent with many other things.
That's right. There's a lot of things.
If that's what you say, is what you say, you're not allowed to start a fire. Mm-hmm. If you're not allowed to start a fire, then you have to be consistent with certain things.
So take all of these things into consideration when you're coming to these conclusions and then be consistent with them. And so thank you for your comments, Darren. Now, Gracie. Gracie brings up – now, this is a good one. As I mentioned last week, Yoel, there are some things that we do, like you just mentioned reading a book, that when you sit down to read a book, you might find that to be a relaxing, restful thing to do. For others, other people might look at that and go, oh, that's just, I don't enjoy reading. It just seems like work to me, and I'm not a reader. I have to read something. It's work. There are some people that like to, for example, knit. You know, they like to sit in their chair, their, you know, whatever it may be doing, and they don't even think about it. Their hands just knit, you know, with wool, knitting needles, things like that. What do you make of that?
So we're going into the world of, again, why is the action being done? So in Jewish practice, as I mentioned, and I'll give a metaphor for this to explain the idea. As I mentioned, in Judaism, anything which is the work itself and anything which is similar to the work. Similar can be completely identical, but the difference would be you're not doing it as your actual profession or as your actual work. You know, when you define the issue of work, it can be something you make money off of, which can mean profession or something you do not do as a profession, but you're still going to be making money off it. Sustaining your everyday life, which can also include making clothing. If you're knitting something, you're actually making clothing. By the way, that was one of the work of women during Shabbat. And that was one of the works that they did in the tabernacle. Uh-huh. Just to explain something, when the rabbis decided how to define work, one of the things they did is that they looked at they looked at the word work in the Torah, and they look at the word work, and you see that it appears a lot with the tabernacle. So the decision in the end was there's 39 types of work, and they're all somehow related to the tabernacle. So if you open up the tractate of Shabbat, if I remember, it's somewhere around the 10th chapter, I think. I mean, you can check it up in a moment if you want. Mm-hmm. But in the tractate of Shabbat, it gives you the list of the 39. And it says that not only is it not something you do to make money, it's also something you do just for the fun of it. So you reach a point where, you know, one of the examples I gave with several people was when you go out to an orchard, can you pick one apple? Whole bunch of apples, you're taking it home, like 2-3 pounds of apples. You went out, you went apple picking. That's something completely different. That's actually type of work. You're collecting food to take home. That's exactly like collecting the manna.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if you want any of this one apple?
You're hungry.
I have that question.
It's lunchtime. You're hungry. Yeah.
Yeah, you want to eat something. Can you pick that one apple? And that's where the distinction is.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I think that's good.
Yeah, in the rabbinical mindset, it's forbidden. it's not that the actual picking of one apple is really the issue. It's the fact that it's similar to the action of picking many apples.
Ah.
That's how philosophical they are about it. Okay. On the other hand, one of the opinions I projected a while ago with a friend of mine who's a Karaite was, what do you do? Can you pick one apple? Is one apple actually work? And the answer in the end was no, it's not work. Why is it not work? Because though the action itself is similar to the action of going apple picking, still there's no reaction to the action except the fact that you're probably going to eat this apple.
Mm.
And it's always a very fine line. And this is why the issue of Shabbat is always very complex to answer.
Mm.
So we go back to the, where were you on this one?
Yeah, knitting.
Oh, so the knitting, yeah. So for example, knitting is, again, another example. It's an action which was done as women's work in the house. So it was actual work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the answer would be no, for a very simple reason. It doesn't matter if your knitting is very small or very big. You're still doing that same action that they used to do even up to 200 years ago. This was women's work in the house. So working, you know.
But most of, I mean, you know, back then they were knitting their own clothes. They were sewing their own clothes. And these days we and I think it's probably unfortunate, but these days we don't do so much of that anymore. We go to the shops, we purchase.
Yeah, but she's still doing the same action. It doesn't matter. She's still sewing a pair of gloves for herself or for someone. That is still the essence of the action. So when it comes to that one, the answer is, as far as I see, the answer is it's not allowed to do it.
So if you were just knitting a little blanket as a gift for someone's baby or something like that, and you're sitting there with your mind is not even on it because you just do it by rote, and you would say that that's highly questionable. That's not just a matter of picking an apple.
Not highly questionable. The answer is no.
Okay. There we go.
I mean, you've noticed I'm very flexible about many things. Here, I think the answer is completely no.
Okay. So there we go. Knitting. Now, while we're on this topic, Yoel, we want to jump to Numbers chapter 15. And after dealing with some of those questions and discussing some of that, it's incredibly
But now
incredibly
we can elaborate. We can elaborate more about what happened there.
We can elaborate what happened there. And this is, if I may, I'm going to start from verse 30 because I think this. The context has to be mentioned here. And so it says, Numbers 15, verse 30 and on, "But the person who does anything presumptuously, whether he is native-born or a stranger, that one brings reproach on the Lord, and he shall be cut off from among his people because he has despised the word of the Lord, that he has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt shall be upon him." Now, it says, while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man, and this bounces off the idea of presumptuous sin, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks, they brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation, and they put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." So as the Lord commanded, Moses and the congregation brought him outside the camp, and they stoned him with stones, and he died. Now, after that, of course, it goes on to talk about the tzitzit, which we will do a program on sometime soon. But at the moment, he was picking up sticks. Now, what does your Hebrew say? I mean, because when we imagine someone picking up sticks, they're out there picking up sticks, sort of, like, so what? But I mean, this
in a playful way. Yeah. So when you say picking up sticks, it's always just picking up sticks to play around with, you know. No, actually, the word here is a very, very specific verb here, which is mekoshesh. Lekashesh, the root of kashash, kuf shin shin, means to collect and gather, bring into one place. He wasn't just picking sticks; he was collecting firewood.
He was collecting firewood, which is a really, I mean, that's a big job, right?
If you're just making a fire for, you know, just to keep yourself warm when you're on your way, or you're just going to cook something, you know, branches and everything. You collect firewood, you collect reasonable pieces of wood, and you make sure you have enough to start the fire and enough to carry on the fire when things start burning out. But still, it's using an action here. This is a form of work.
Mm.
He's collecting firewood. What is the fire for is irrelevant at the moment. So, by the way, a lot of people link this to the issue of fire. Oh, it's really has to do with the process of producing fire. It was very difficult, stuff like that. Again, collecting firewood is not a very difficult thing, unless you're in an area where wood is very, very scarce. That's a possibility. But in the desert, and there's nothing around, it's one thing. But when you're in a forest or you have trees in your area, it's not that difficult.
Mm.
But again, some people link it to the issue of production of fire.
So with this particular commandment or this example that is given, although coming back to Exodus 35 verse 3, that I come to the conclusion that if it's not work-related fire, no problem. But what I do is I make a conscious effort to make sure that I have all of my firewood ready to go. I don't have to go collecting any fire or kindling or anything on the Sabbath. It's already cut. It's there. It's just outside the door, and it's ready to go. I don't have to worry about it. It's easy. Not so with this chap. He's on the day before Shabbat. He didn't prepare, and now he finds himself wanting to keep his fire going or whatever it may be, and he's gone out to do the work and to collect the wood and so on and so forth. And that seems to be, one might assume, jumping off the previous verses, a presumptuous sin. It's like it's as if he's gone, I don't care that it's Shabbat, I've run out of wood, I'm going to go get wood, I don't care, I'm doing it now.
Well, we don't know that as a fact. We don't know that's what happened. What's very good is he actually took the text from the right spot, and this is a story to give an example of what does it mean to do something deliberately. So the person probably knew it was Shabbat, and he anyhow went out to pick wood. So that can be presumptuous, or that this person didn't know it was Shabbat, or didn't know you're not allowed to do this type of work, and that's what we call shgaga, and it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
But again, shgaga is from the word shogeg, to make a mistake, to be mistakenly wrong. Not deliberately wrong, but by mistake being wrong.
Sure. So unintentional sin, which it actually deals with in the previous verses from verse 22 on.
Exactly. So what exactly were the exact circumstances of the type of work is not 100% clear, but it's very obvious that they had to execute him, which means either he knew it was Shabbat, and he anyhow did it.
Mm.
So, again, these are fine details. I mean, again, one of the problems is when you ask a Jew about this stuff, we have a lot of details in our heads. We can dissect this to death. So I'm going to try and avoid these dissection formations.
But I guess it's like, as you say, and it's fair to say, it doesn't say it explicitly in the text, but I do think it is a fair conclusion to come to, because God says to Moses, you've got to stone him. The people have got to stone him. And when we come back to verses 30 and 31, as 31 ends, it says, you know, if they've broken the commandment, that person shall be completely cut off. His guilt shall be upon him. And I mean, I think it's fair to say this guy was completely cut off.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, because the two examples given here is a mistake and something was deliberate. So, yeah.
Mm.
If a person makes a mistake, he says, I didn't know it was Shabbat or whatever it is, I didn't know this is forbidden, that's one thing. So the example here is really a person who knew it was forbidden anyhow did it.
Mm, so he was defiant.
Yeah, he was defiant. I think it's very, very clear that this is what happened here, based on the examples before it. So now, I agree with you on that one.
Here is a question, and we're jumping off the topic a little bit, but I've had people ask this a number of times. When you talk about things like this, a lot of people go back in their mind's eye. They think, you know, back in so many months ago, even a couple of years ago or whatever, I remember, you know, I knew it was Shabbat, but darn it, I wanted to do this and I just did it. And now I'm looking at this and I'm really feeling quite repentant about that, because I shouldn't have done it. What am I to do? Am I completely cut off? What can I do in this situation? Because there's no sacrifice for intentional defiant sin. What is one to do? Is there a remedy for this at all?
oh no, you've gone there. I don't really have an answer for that one. Again, this is a very, very dangerous thing to say on such a program, because, you know, people say, oh, we have Yeshua to solve that one. No, I don't have an answer for that.
Can I make a suggestion? You tell me if it's a fair thing to at least consider. When we find ourselves in Ezekiel 18 and Ezekiel 33, that says, if you are repentant, if you do turn with all your heart from your sin, then the sin that you have done shall not be remembered. But what we're relying upon, solely relying upon, is the sovereign declaration of our God to say, I will forgive you because of your repentance. And that's all we have is His mercy.
I agree. Yes, I agree with that. But there's also the technicalities of it. So, meaning, if you did something you were not supposed to do, there's still a necessity here of atonement.
Mm.
The usual kind of like joke that we have in the Jewish world is that there's going to be a very, very, very long line to the altar when the temple's rebuilt.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, that's probably not too far-fetched, too, really.
Yeah. So I'm saying if God did something, he also says, Machatzti v'ani erpa, it says in Isaiah, I have crushed and I will be the one to heal.
Mm.
He's put us in a certain situation, no matter, he will also find the solution.
Mm.
And each person can interpret that any way they want. I'm not going to be picky about this at the moment.
Mm. Mm. No, it's fair enough. But I know that you mentioned Yeshua, but even Hebrews chapter 10, I believe it is, quotes from Numbers chapter 15, and it reminds everyone, there is no sacrifice for intentional, defiant, presumptuous sin. You only have the mercy of God to fall back on. And I suppose one good thing is that if you're worried about it, it would suggest that you're repentant about it. If you're repentant about it, you won't do it again. If you don't do it again, he knows. And
And don't worry, he'll take care of it.
He'll take care of
it. He's the one who makes the decision, so don't worry.
He does. He's sovereign. Amen. Is there anywhere else that we want to go with Shabbat? Because we've invested some time into this. I'm looking at part three already.
Oh, well, we're going to have part three. It's obvious. I mean, the question is, are we going to go beyond that? Again, the definition of work is very, very subtle. It's very complex in certain cases. Again, each person has to keep their mind open. Every time something's questionable, I personally take the more strict way. You know, I have a friend who always says to me, if it's not written, it's not forbidden. My response is, we have to take a slightly more careful process in this. So we have to be very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
but again, taking Jewish law, it's something that's not very fair to do in the Jewish world, but the difference in between Jewish law and biblical law, there is a difference. Sometimes a massive difference. But if we sum everything up, in the Bible itself, when they said work, it just meant work, anything which is a type of work.
Mm.
Now, again, when you deal with work, you have to divide work up into what men did, what women did, what people who were farmers did, and people who were office workers that did. And basically, you really have to start thinking, for example, writing on Shabbat. Is writing forbidden? So I forbid it because I take a more general approach that if it's a type of work, that's it. So I don't write during Shabbat. But some people would say, oh, the only prohibition of people to write are people whose job is to write.
Okay.
So that goes into the issue of shaving, working on your computer. Classic example I went through is, for example, the issue of cutting fruits and vegetables during Shabbat. I use a knife. I use it in a professional way.
Yeah, that's
and I do it really, really fast. Can I cut salad for Shabbat? Can I, as a professional, cut the salad for Shabbat? That's a very good question because I use knives as my profession. I use knives for cutting up. You know, stuff like that. There's a balance here you have to keep. I would say regarding the issue, if there are any chefs out there or cooks or whatever it would be that are working, that are listening to this, I would say that the issue of chopping up a salad, chopping anything up when you want to eat, the practice in Judaism is that you are allowed to cut vegetables even if you're a professional, because this is not considered to be work because you have to eat.
True.
And you want to make the salad, that's something completely different.
But, yeah, but again, this to so many different. I mean, it's say, for example,
exactly.
You're a professional musician. Are you allowed to sit down on Shabbat and relax with your instrument, or is that considered work?
Exactly. Mm. So there are places where sometimes the rule is a bit different. You know, say you're allowed to play music during Shabbat, which technically you are allowed to play music during Shabbat. The rabbis just forbid it for certain reasons. But for example, you just sit there and it's for your own enjoyment. My understanding is it's okay. Same thing with the salad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Same thing, for example, if you use your computer during Shabbat. Yeah. You know, if your computer is your work computer, but you're sitting there to you're doing something more for your fun on the computer, then I don't see a problem with that.
But then there's you see, here we are. We're waiting around in the gray area, you and I, at the moment, because now people are saying to themselves, okay, but what about the knitting example that you just gave and you said no way? I mean, what if it's your knitting, it's pleasurable for you, it's something that you do, but
That's the difference. Here she's producing the clothing as clothing
so
to be used by someone.
There's a product.
It's
in
a
the
product.
End.
Even if he doesn't make money off of it, and I know I understand this. There's subtleties here, and you have to have this mindset to be able to fully understand it.
Mm.
Let me give a very simple example, and I hope people understand this and be able to understand where I'm coming from. I'm going to take an example as a Hebrew teacher.
Mm.
When I teach Hebrew, you start a person off in different levels. Okay, you have a person who already knows the alphabet, a person who already knows the vowel points, X, Y, Z, whatever it would be. Or you can take an example of your children. Whatever it would be, any example. I'm just going to give an example and try to take it as a general idea for everything in life. When you're not a professional, you don't see subtleties. You don't see little details.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not coming from the approach as, you know, you have to have a rabbi to answer every question. Rabbis know it all. No, rabbis are human beings, but they're human beings with more experience.
Sure.
This is why, for example, in the Torah, it says the elders. Why the elders? Why doesn't it say the wise ones or whatever it would be? It says elders because elders have more experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you're highly experienced, then fine, but you have to be humble. You have to be very, very humble. We have a saying in Judaism, who is wise? He who studies from all. As my very good friend Nechemia Golden said several times, the sign of a real scholar is one that admits that he doesn't know all.
Mm.
And that's a very, very important thing.
Mm.
So again, even if you make a decision and you discover you were wrong, you don't sit there and start crying about it. Try to understand why you were wrong, where the mistake lies,
and then adjust.
And adjust it. And that's it. You know, I make mistakes left, right, and center. I mean, I put on my Facebook a joke where I said, no, my wife proved me wrong twice on the same day. And I admit it. I made a mistake. You know? So again, it's knowledge and understanding is a process. You might be in this process your entire life. I mean, one of the things that I spoke with people in the martial arts world that have been studying for 20, 30 years, they tell me it's a journey that ends when you die.
Mm.
Same thing here. Torah is a journey that ends when we die. I mean, you might have all the technical knowledge, but there's a lot of mental knowledge you develop as well.
Exactly,
and that's how you develop that.
Yeah.
This is one of the practices in Judaism. We practice a lot the issue of how to deal with gray areas. And many, many of the questions rabbis receive are in the gray area.
Yeah, sure. And so we're always adjusting, we're always learning, we're always reevaluating. But the most important thing, I suppose, when it comes to the gray area is to take as much information about that particular topic as you can, make up your mind based on the information that you have, be consistent with the conclusion that you come to, and hey, if you come a little further down the line and you come into some additional information or a different understanding that you didn't have before, then adjust it. But so hopefully these programs so far have been able to give people information that they didn't have before, able to help them consider ways of doing things on Shabbat that they didn't have before so that they can come to better informed conclusions. That's certainly one of the aims of these programs. And I think we better wrap it up there because otherwise we're going to be moving into part three, but undoubtedly there's going to be part three of Shabbat. We've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo here on Truth to You. And just a reminder, everybody, he is my Hebrew teacher. The email address, if you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. That's hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. So in the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.